so can the matter-first camp, despite the quantum Zeno effect. It tells us that we will never see a particular molecule undergo a transition as long as we insist on looking at it. In fact, the more observations you make, the more frozen the unstable system will be. So it must follow that the more we look at the world, and the closer we get to its finest structure, the more we are freezing it in place. Somehow, observation gives specificity to reality. Reality slips through Sherlock Holmes's magnifying glass just when he thinks he spotted a clue. But before the mind-first camp starts to cheer, the quantum Zeno effect has bad news for them, too. There is no separate observer. The matter-first people are stuck because they can't report what a physical system is doing when it behaves naturally. The mind-first people are stuck because they can't produce an independent observer. The so-called observer effect only works if an observer can stand outside the system he wants to observe. You can chop the observer up, as it were, by asking him to take a measurement of one small thing, such as detecting a photon as it passes through a slit. If you watch all the time, however, the observer has no way to step back from the thing he's watching. This is why the quantum Zeno effect is sometimes called the watchdog effect. Imagine a bulldog chained to the back door of a house. The dog has been trained to keep its eyes on the back door constantly, and to bark if anything suspicious happens. Unfortunately, the bulldog is so fixed on guarding the back door that burglars can sneak in the front door or a side window or anywhere else they please. You might as well not have a watchdog. In the same way, any observation made in physics locks the observer's attention on a single thing. As long as the two are locked, anything else could be happening all around and no one would know it. You might as well not have an observer. This lock between observer and observed lies at the heart of the quantum Zeno effect. How can we break the lock? There's a good deal of controversy over that. Maybe the lock can't be broken. Maybe it can be broken through an equation, but not in real life. Amidst all this speculation, something wonderful has occurred. Reality has spoken for itself, which was just the thing we needed. Reality's message is intimate. I have you in my embrace. We are locked together, and the more you try to break away, the tighter my embrace becomes. In other words, matter first and mind first must both surrender to reality first. The observer has nowhere to stand outside reality. He's like a fish who wants to escape the sea, only to find that if it jumps out of the water, it perishes. For human beings, participating in the universe is how we exist. To exist is to be aware. That's the long and the short of it for human beings. Astonishingly, the same is true for the universe. Without consciousness, it would vanish in a puff of smoke, like a dream, leaving nothing behind and no one to know that it ever existed. Even to say that the universe is conscious doesn't go far enough. As we will convincingly argue, the universe is consciousness itself. Until that conclusion is accepted, reality's message hasn't been completely heard. How did life first begin? Shakespeare has an unsettling habit of mixing nobility with tomfoolery. So that mad King Lear shaking his fist at a thunderstorm has no companion in the pouring rain, but the poor fool who served him at court. A grinning death's head is always around the next corner in Hamlet. Hamlet utters high-flown sentiments, like, what a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty. Meanwhile, the first gravedigger, sometimes listed as first clown, cracks jokes about how fast a corpse will decay when the ground is wet, including the corpses of great men. His jesting throws Hamlet into a morbid mood. In the end, what good are noble thoughts? He asks, "Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might stop a hole to keep the wind away." In science, physics is Hamlet, and biology is the first gravedigger. Physics expresses itself in elegant equations, while biology deals with the messiness of life and death. Physicists dissect space-time. Biologists dissect flatworms and frogs. For a long time, physics wasn't concerned with the mystery of life. Erwin Schrödinger wrote a small book titled, "What is Life?" But his colleagues generally viewed it as an eccentricity, a piece of mysticism rather than science, at least not the science of relativity and quantum mechanics, which was the business Schrödinger was trained to attend to. Actually, he was trying to connect genetics with physics. But at that time, 1944, the structure of DNA was still unknown. Even after the discovery of the double helix in the following decade, physics remained aloof from biology, a situation that has changed only gradually in the last few decades. Equations and theories, scientific data and results, are faraway things. Life is with us here and now. One of the most peculiar things about being alive is that we don't know how it happened and when it did happen. If you look at any living thing, a cold virus, T-Rex, tree fern, or newborn baby, it was preceded by another living thing. Life comes out of life. Clearly, this doesn't tell us where life first began. And yet the transition from dead matter to living matter somehow occurred. In biochemistry, this pivotal moment is explained by setting inorganic chemicals on one side and organic chemicals on the other. An organic chemical is defined as a chemical that appears only in living things, organisms. Salt is inorganic, meaning it is not based on carbon, for example, while the flood of proteins and enzymes manufactured by DNA is organic. But it's not clear that this time-honored division really helps if you want to know how life first began. The separation of organic and inorganic chemicals is valid as chemistry, but not as a definition of life. Some amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, may be present on the surface of meteorites. In fact, one theory about the origin of life holds that the first spark came from such meteorites landing on Earth. To be brutally frank, life is a major inconvenience for physics. Biology doesn't fit into abstract equations. If you consider what the experience of life feels like, even biology may be inadequate to explain it. Life contains purpose, meaning, direction, and goals. Organic chemicals do not. It isn't tenable that chains of proteins somehow looked around and learned to do the things associated with living organisms. That's like saying that stones in a New England field looked around and decided to become a Yankee farmer's fence. And even if salt is dead, life cannot exist without its participation. Every cell in the body contains salt as a necessary chemical ingredient. The fact that life comes from life implies that living things want to keep going. Unless extinction becomes total, evolution is apparently an unstoppable force. But why? Eons ago, to be precise, some 66 million years ago, we are told a giant meteor struck Earth and wiped out all the dinosaurs, probably because the collision created so much dust in the atmosphere that sunlight was blocked and the planet became too cold for dinosaurs to survive, or else because plant life withered away and the entire food chain collapsed, making the survival of very large creatures impossible. From this mass extinction, the creatures that survived, tiny and insignificant as they were, didn't remain tiny and insignificant. The age of the mammals became possible. A new blossoming took hold, and the post-dinosaur world now looks far richer and more diverse than what came before. The surge of life is both obvious and mystifying. The blue-green algae that form on the surface of ponds haven't evolved for hundreds of millions of years. Neither have sharks, plankton, horseshoe crabs, dragonflies, or a host of other life forms that lived alongside the dinosaurs. What causes some creatures to stay put, while others gallop ahead on the evolutionary track, as pre-hominids did, creating Homo sapiens in record time, a matter of 2 or 3 million years, instead of tens or hundreds of millions? It's an axiom in science that the relevant questions are about how, not why. We want to know how electricity works, not why people want bigger flat-screen televisions. But the evolution of life keeps bringing up issues of why. Why did moles abandon the light to live underground? Why do pandas eat only bamboo leaves? Why do people want children? Some kind of purpose and meaning had to enter the picture. Or did a conscious universe contain the seeds of purpose and meaning since the beginning? As matters stand, such speculation is met with considerable resistance by the scientific community. The standard view holds that the universe has no purpose or meaning. So, before offering a new model for how life began, we must dismantle conventional thinking first. In a conscious universe, everything is alive already. The observation that life comes from life turns out to be a cosmic truth. Grasping the mystery. The chemicals in the human body are the reason the body is alive. At the head of all organic chemicals is one, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, which contains the code of life. Yet, if you stand back, this seems like an awkward, perhaps infeasible way to unravel the mystery of where life began. Carbon, sulfur, salt, and water are supposedly dead, while at the same time being totally necessary to life. So why should organic chemicals be considered privileged? What any living thing does, whether it's a microbe, butterfly, elephant, or palm tree, isn't the same as what it's made of. No shuffling around of chemicals will cause a piano to write a piece of music. Like the human body, the wood that encases a piano is composed entirely of organic chemicals, primarily cellulose. Nothing about cellulose explains the music of the Beatles, or any other. Likewise, jiggling around the chemistry of the human body doesn't explain any living activity a person performs. Genetics would seem to be on wobbly ground. You might make a special plea for the chemicals in the human body as opposed to the lifeless chemicals in seawater and a piece of wood. But there will always be a hidden fallacy, a weak link that snaps. One way to illustrate this is through an aspect of every living cell known as nanomachines, microscopic entities that function like production plants to manufacture the chemicals a cell needs in order to survive and multiply. Our cells don't need to reinvent the wheel. DNA isn't made from scratch every time a new cell is created. Instead, DNA splits itself in half in order to form a mirror image of itself, and that becomes the genetic material for a new cell. How this act of self-replication comes about has no explanation, but we'll leave this mystery aside. The cell doesn't want to make other chemicals from scratch either. Evolution has led to a host of fixed machines that persist intact during the life of a cell. They are like coal and steel plants that never close down or get dismantled no matter how much change occurs in the city around them. A particular zone in the cell, known as the mitochondrion, which provides the energy for the cell, is so stable a nanomachine that it gets passed on unchanged, generation after generation. You inherited your mitochondrial DNA from your mother, and she from her mother, as far back as human evolution can be traced. In one form or other, the mitochondrion has been stable in every living cell as its energy factory. The traffic of air and food inside a cell is constantly swirling and changing, but nanomachines are immune to this traffic. In fact, they guide it in many ways. The machinery of life? If we want to get at the very beginning of life, nanomachines sit at the very heart of the mystery. But first, like Alice, we have to go through the looking glass into a world where the tiniest things, atoms and molecules, loom large. They are in control of reality at the microscopic level. Whatever happens in nature, whether in the center of a supernova, the gas clouds of deep space, or a living cell, is happening through the interaction of atoms and molecules. Nothing else is germane to how life began in material terms. If atoms and molecules cannot accomplish the job on their own, it can't be done. This is what current biology holds. For the moment, we'll exclude quanta, although we'll return to them later. Atoms interact with each other almost instantaneously. You may have heard of chemicals known as free radicals that exist in the human body, being involved in many processes, both destructive and constructive. Free radicals, therefore, are double-edged swords. They are associated with aging and inflammation, for example, yet at the same time, they are necessary for healing wounds. The basic thing that free radicals do is quite simple, however. They steal electrons from other atoms and molecules. Their own count of electrons is unstable because of exposure to radiation, smoking, and other environmental factors, or from the body's own natural processes. The immune system creates free radicals to steal electrons from invading bacteria and viruses as a way of neutralizing them. The most common atom involved in electron stealing is oxygen. When its electron count becomes unstable, oxygen latches on to the nearest electron it can steal. Therefore, free radicals are highly reactive and usually very short-lived. For living organisms and their cells, this is a life-or-death matter.